this is Nancy Duterte. I'm the author of How to Talk to an Alien, and you can find out more about my work at theskepticalpsychic.com or talkalien.com. You are listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. He is one of the most generous radio show hosts I have ever had the pleasure of working with. I think I'm going to call him Hieronymus the Magnanimous.
No, I'm really Hieronymus Hippopotamus. That's what they used to call me in high school. And I was not too happy about that. But it's okay now. I wouldn't mind being called a hippopotamus. Well, guys and gals, our next guest is Dr. Rita Louise. Her book is The E.T. Chronicles, What Myths and Legends Tell Us About Human Origins, and is published by our friends at Hampton Roads Publishing. The E.T. Chronicles grapples with the big questions, such as, who are we? Where do we come from? Why are we here? Well, through a careful reading of world mythology, I wish we had a lot more courses in world mythology in high school and college these days. And she also covers creation myths, gods and goddesses, heaven, the gods and their toys, spaceships or chariots, and quest for immortality. And about this author, she's a radio personality, a medical intuitive. Dr. Rita Louise is the host of Just Energy Radio and the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. She's the author of hundreds of articles that have been published worldwide. She has appeared on radio, TV, and has spoken at national conferences covering topics such as health and healing and ghosts, intuition, ancient mysteries, the paranormal, and her website is www.ritalouise.com. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Dr. Rita.
Hey, Dr. Bob, how's it going?
Well, my pitching arm is all right. How's yours doing? Is it okay?
It's a little sore today, but for the most part, I'm doing great.
It's about time you have been doing great, because I remember the old days when you used to throw sliders and curveballs, and I could never hit them, but now I've grown older and I can do it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, I really enjoyed your book, E.T. Chronicles, and I learned more about other things, not just E.T.s. What inspired you to write E.T. Chronicles?
Well, one of the things that happened, we started working on the book in about 2009 because of all of the stories about the Mayan calendar. I mean, that's what started the whole thing. You know, all these people coming forward saying, you know, the world's coming to an end, or it's not going to come to an end. And there was a show on TV that said, well, in the Mayan culture, they talk about this, and they told all these details about the five cycles of time and this and this. And they said, and they talk about the same things in Egypt and in Hinduism, but they gave no details. You know, an inquiring mind have to know. And so I started digging into cycles of time in Hindu cosmology, and, well, one, found out they didn't really talk about the same thing. But in the middle of that, I found a flood legend that read incredibly like the story of Noah. Mm-hmm. So I started digging into that, and what I found was actually quite remarkable. But by the time I got to the end of that little investigation, I realized in this whole creation narrative, I was really kind of at the end of the story and needed to go back to, and as I like to say, in the beginning, and move forward from where mythology talks about where we started and bring the story forward in time. And that's really how the book started.
Well, what was your focus, the focus of your investigation in the beginning?
I mean, it looked at different cultures' creation myths. I mean, the focus of the book was to take mythology and try to give it a timeline. So it wasn't just to look at this myth story or this myth story, but to basically start with how different cultures represented creation in their cosmology and create a timeline. And where the timeline ended was basically with the rise of civilization in, the Sumerian culture, with the advent of writing. because then we could tell our own stories.
Right.
And it was quite the adventure, I have to tell you.
Well, it certainly was, and I enjoyed reading this aspect of it. You know, in Sumeria, usually most people, when they talk about Sumeria these days, have been always referring to Zechariah Sitchin. And he is not in your bibliography, but you do refer to him earlier. And he was a good friend of ours, but we had a lot of fights. What I mean, not they weren't fights. You know, we wanted, we really, since I was, I've done murals at Johns Hopkins University, and I became involved with their religious department and things like that. I really wanted him to talk to them about his theories. He never would do it. And when he passed on, I learned why. But I'm glad that you didn't necessarily turn him into a god in your particular book.
Well, I mean, I had read the Earth Chronicle series. Anybody that's in this line of work probably has read the Earth Chronicle series. And, I didn't want to prove the Bible to be true, and I didn't want to prove his work to be true. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do my own research to find out what myth says. And, I mean, I think he was a great researcher, and I think what he brought forward for people to think about and ponder was great. But I had a couple of issues. I have to tell you, I had a couple of issues with his work because I could never find the gold. And his whole premise was based on gold, and I could not find it in the mythological record.
I see.
I mean, we have this love for gold, and there are things that you could make assumptions about, but there was not a clear mythic line that brought you to the gold, not across the board and across cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Sumerian record, that was the part that killed me.
Well, but you do have excellent sources. You got a great bibliography. The 1998 sources, I'm trying to find those particular areas right now, introduced me to a lot of other good research that I wish he probably would have gotten more involved in. When you love someone like I loved him and cared for what he was trying to accomplish, I just felt like he could have used and spread himself out a little bit more in other areas. And I wish he had, because there's so many people that took what he said absolutely for verbatim, and there were quite a few mistakes there. And I just wish it wouldn't have happened that way. But we just couldn't talk him into doing any of the debates that we thought would teach him something about that. But I'm sorry I took so long on this. It's not as important.
But I think it is a very important thing to talk about, because you're right. People do put him on a pedestal, and there are people that have taken his work and used it as the base premise and then created their own work off of it. But if you're starting with a flawed theory, then everything is, mm-hmm. the fruit of the poisonous vine, or however that phrase goes.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. And that's the reason why I thought he has great importance today, but I think he has misled quite a few people, not intentionally, but it could have been better, let's put it that way. J.A. Black and G. Cunningham and J. Ebeling from the 1998 research that was done in there, and I think that really really was important that you give other people other sources, because I don't think he generally mentioned those things. Now, when you use the word god or gods, what do you mean? How do you determine that the gods were or not omnipotent? I always got that one right.
Well, when we think of God, we think of this almighty creator that underscored reality, underscored the universe, whether you're talking about the creation of the planets, the creation of humanity, whatever, but this omnipotent creator. But when we read myths, even in the Bible, you know, we don't find this creator who can wink his eye or wiggle his nose or nod his head or, you know, I always think of Q from Star Trek, you know, and he just snaps his finger and, you know, and moves his arm and things come into reality. But when you read mythology, these gods had to fly around in chariots. They had magnificent, you know, weapons that could level mountains. They had tools. You know, there is Freya, who's a Norse god, who had a cloak of feathers that allowed her to fly through the skies. And so when you start reading some of these stories, you find out they were not able to do these things on their own, but relied on technology in order to achieve their goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not omnipotent.
That's
just like you and me.
Yeah. I think that was a very extremely important point to make, that they the gods that we're talking about there weren't omnipotent. And, you know, then, of course, if they are extraterrestrial, that these gods are extraterrestrial, do you believe that these gods are, or some of them are?
I do believe that they are, and I feel like there are stories that we have received that talk about this group of beings coming in a cosmic egg, and I'm just going to use a very simple term, a cosmic egg. And even in the Bible, you know, in the beginning God created the heaven and earth, and the earth was dark and void. You know, I used to know that by heart. And you find this consistency of this vastness, and if you interpret it in a certain way, of space. And these stories talk about these beings or the things necessary to create life being in these cosmic eggs. I mean, in one story, and it was a Chinese myth that talks about, you know, this cosmic egg comes and lands on the earth, and it sat there for a very long time. And then finally it opened up, and all the plants and all of the animals emerged from this egg. I think, you know, and so people look at that and they'll say one thing, you know, they talk about consciousness, but if you just kind of take it at face value for what they're saying, it sounds more like a ship. And one of the things that we impressed, you know, in our mind was that we needed to find consistency of storyline, because if we found multiple cultures, and I'm not talking Egyptian, Sumerian, and Greek, I'm talking Sumerian, Dogon, and Native American, South American, if we were finding these same storylines around the world, we knew we had something. You know, and so those are the ones that are included in the book. And so you find a consistency of seven or eight individuals in this cosmic egg and coming to the earth or coming here.
Well, right now, we got to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be with our guest. As a matter of fact, Rita, do you mind if I call you Dr. Rita?
You sure can.
Oh, good. All right. Because there, you know, there's, I better stop it here. I got to ask this question as soon as we get back. We'll be right back with our guest. E.T. Chronicles, What Myth and Legend Tells Us About Human Origin. And that is published by Hamden Rose.
Stay connected with stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Lucera. After its victory in South...
21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
It's so hard to figure what it's all about
when your outside's in.
Oh, wait a a second, producer. We got to hear it. Here's George Harrison.
Yeah, you're upside right.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm the alleged Dr. Bob Hieronymus, a lowly PhD hanging out in this part of the universe. And, of course, our executive producer and research assistant, who is my boss and tells me everything I got to do, is Laura Kortner. And our engineer is Charlie Hines. Our guest at this time is Dr. Rita Louise. The E.T. Chronicles, What Myths and Legends Tell Us About Human Origins, with Wayne... And I think this is Lali Liberté. I don't believe I pronounced it correctly, but I'll get beat up on this one. Hamden Rhodes Publishing. How do you pronounce Wayne's last name?
You are pretty close. La Liberté.
Oh, really?
I mean, unless you say it with a French accent, which I'm not even going to go there.
Okay. Well, that's a beautiful name. But he's passed on. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
He must have been really something. Okay. Well, hey, by the way, on the web, you can go to the web, www.soulhealer.com. Soulhealer.com. Oh, gosh, Rudy, I have to give away your book right now before it gets too late. How would you like to win a copy of this book, The E.T. Chronicles, What Myths and Legends Tell Us About Human Origins by Dr. Rita Louise? And Wayne, La Liberté,
Perfect. That was perfect.
Hey, I had 7 years of French, and I forgot it all. Now, here's the question. Third caller. Let's do it this way. Third caller is the winner. Our numbers are 410-922-6680, 410-WCBM-680, or 1-800-WCBM-680. Okay. Now, I've got some important questions for you.
Okay.
All right. Especially, I learned a lot from your book. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure I read it this time. There, on pages 65 to 66, you note that God wanted to have a one-on-one with his people. How did it turn out?
Do I have to grab my copy of the book and look it up?
It's page 65 to 66.
Hold on one quick sec.
Okay.
Okay, let's see.
This was so surprising to me. I really enjoyed it. I had no idea.
Well,
that
you know,
happened.
I was told that I have a... You know that I take story narratives and then I give it my own flair. So... Mm-hmm. In where I talk about where God wanted to have a one-on-one with his people, I'm sharing the story of God appearing to Moses. So, you know, as we all know from the Ten Commandments, God comes and meets with Moses on the top of Mount Sinai. Well, and God wanted to interact with the people and told Moses that, you know, in 3 days or whatever the time frame was, that I'm going to come back and I'm going to talk to my people. And so, you know, not taking the story verbatim, I just was like, he wanted to have a one-on-one. I was being a little humorous in my narrative. But the part I found interesting in that storyline is that, you know, people just make the assumption that that Moses was the only one that interacted with God. But when God does come back, there's thunder and lightning on the top of Mount Sinai, and this booming sound comes out, and he starts talking to the people, and they all get scared, and they're telling Moses, like, tell him to go away. We'll do whatever you say. whatever you say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it wasn't just Moses that had that experience, and for a story like that to come down to us, to me, there had to be something going on. It wasn't just people believing Moses. It was people having their experience with this thing that was much larger than them.
Would you describe, you know, it seems to be when we didn't talk too much about extraterrestrials, but we'll need to return to that soon. But when these large craft, if let's call them that, were seen, They came with lots of thunder and clouds and it was they were very very difficult to experience. That reminds me a lot of the movie E.T. or was mm-hmm. yes, you know, when the crafts are coming in, you see all these real dark rolling black clouds and that kind of thing, and I see that description in several places in this work that you have, so that it becomes really almost like a staged experience on that. Now, let's get back to these extraterrestrials, because I think this is quite important. If the gods are extraterrestrial, where did they come from, and how did they get here?
Okay. And so, based on what I could find, there is only one culture that actually directly identifies a star group, and that would be the Dogon, who say that the gods came from Cirrus.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start looking at the stories, you find a number of star groups that come up over and over again. And that's the Pleiades. You find references to the Pleiades around the world, or something happens to a person or a group of people and they become the Pleiades, but that's a big one. The North Star, Draco, is another one, and Orion. And so those are the four different star groups that you see repeated in mythology. You know, mm-hmm. only the Dogon say that that's where the gods came from, but that's kind of my assertion, is that there is a connection between us and them and those star groups. You know, and you were mentioning Zachariah Sitchin, and I'm going to use that as an example. You know, in his work, he just talked about the Anunnaki, and people run around, and I'm sure you hear this yourself, you know, the Anunnaki. But when you read the stories, what you find is that we're not really talking about, and this is my viewpoint, that we're not really talking about one race of gods. We are talking about multiple races of gods because they're described in different ways. We have one group that, and I'm going to use current vernacular, that appear to be reptilian-ish. We have another group that we would perhaps associate with, like, the Nordics, you know, that we were created in God's image. And so which are the sky gods, which I would assume were these Caucasian extraterrestrials. We have ones that are identified as being monsters. We have ones that are identified as being giants. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like it wasn't just one group of gods. I mean, unless you're using the term Anunnaki as a generic term to reference multiple races of extraterrestrials.
Well, you know, recently there's been some discussion on a new planet in our solar system. I don't know if this has been confirmed, but one that is, they call it number 9. Is that what they call it? The number 9?
I don't know what they call it, but I'm familiar with what you're talking about, the one that's out past Pluto.
Correct, yes.
It's not a planet anymore.
Yeah. so Pluto's not a planet anymore, right? But do you think that could be in any way linked to, because a lot of people have asked me this and I don't know the answer, to what Zechariah Sitchin was saying was Nibiru?
Well, you know, I kind of had a little problem with that one myself. Even though it sounded really good, but if it had a 3,600-year cycle,
yeah,
we would have had it visual sometime in recorded history. We
yeah.
have 5,000 years of recorded history, and we have no documented sightings of it.
Mm-hmm.
We have no oral tradition of it.
That's right. That's correct. So, well, then you intimate that we are not, this is really important, not the product of creation nor evolution, but we were somehow engineered. How did you come to that conclusion?
Okay. Well, I'm going to start even a little earlier. My feeling is, based on the story narrative that I share in E.T. Chronicles, was that these extraterrestrials that came, that group of eight that came, actually terraformed the planet and were directly related to the development and evolution of life on Earth. With that said, you know, scientists have been looking for the missing link for 150 years and have yet to find it. But when they start looking at the genetic shifts, one of the things that they found was that the difference between Australopithecines and Homo ergaster. Anyway, but the difference between them are so great. You know, they grew taller in stature. They could stand upright. They had the ability to vocalize. And all of these changes happened in less than 2 million years. And scientists cannot figure out how this series of changes that really had no movement or very little movement for millions of years could all transpire in such a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are the changes that happened in humanity, but there are other things that we find on the planet that we just don't have an explanation for. And I have to tell you that some of the even most mundane things just make you scratch your head and they boggle your mind. Now, this one, I don't think anyone has ever brought up, but I find it fascinating. Dr. Bob, did you know that domesticated animals, the first domesticated animals, not counting the dog, began about 8,000 B.C.?
No, ma'am, I didn't.
So between 8,000 B.C. and 2,500 B.C., every single animal that has been domesticated on the planet were domesticated. So that was a 5,000-year period, and we're talking not just in the European area, we're talking worldwide. And so we had llamas and some other animals that were domesticated in South America right around the same time they were domesticated in Europe and Middle East. Around 4,000 B.C., all of the animals of labor were domesticated. So we're talking the horse, the camel, and the llama. And they all were domesticated in a 1,500-year window.
Can you make your point within the next 10 seconds?
I can make my point in the next 10 seconds. In the next 5,000 years, so in our last 5,000 years, we have yet to domesticate one more animal.
Very interesting. Whoa, I did not know that. I learned a lot from your book, but I didn't know that as well. And we are just about out of time, unfortunately. Darn it, Rita. Does anyone ever talk to you about being Rita the meter maid?
Well, you know, I've had my days where, actually, I was a meter maid for Halloween one year, and
there, were you?
Didn't get it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us. It went too fast, darn it.
Way
too fast is right. So we look forward to you joining us again in the future. Thank you very much, Dr. Rita Louise. The book is The E.T. Chronicles, What Myths and Legends Tell Us About Human Origins, and it's published by Hampton Roads Publishing on the web, www.soulhealer.com.